Okay. We're continuing with Krishna entering Dwarka. We heard about the great personalities, the leading personalities of Dwarka going to receive Krishna. And then we heard about the Brahmana learned speakers and genealogists and historians, and the Shudra expert dramatists, artists, and dancers and singers. We heard about Krishna reciprocating with each of them as appropriate for their position. And now we're going to hear how Krishna received and how the ladies received him, the ladies of Dwarka. Focus now is upon the ladies. Texts 23-24 of chapter 11. Then the Lord personally entered the city, accompanied by, oh, we read this, 23 we read, elderly relatives and invalid brahmanas with their wives, all offering benedictions and singing the glories of the Lord. Others praise the glories of the Lord. So we're reading 24-25. When Lord Krishna passed over the public roads, all the ladies from the respectable families of Dwarka went up to the roofs, or roofs, of their palaces just to have a look at the Lord. They considered this to be the greatest festival. And the largest part of the purport, Prabhupada is discussing festivals where persons go to see the form of the Lord is the darshan of the deity, the archavigraha. And he speaks about largest numbers of persons who attend such festivals are the ladies. Elsewhere he speaks that ladies are naturally soft-hearted, and therefore their inclination for devotional expression is very natural, very easy. For men it's more difficult because of the rational, yeah, but what if, however, maybe, and so on. All that noise. So, when seeing the Lord in the deity form and seeing Krishna entering into Dwarka as the ladies are seeing him, it's none different. And how is it none different? How do we understand what the Archa Vigraha is? It's not, leaving aside that here in India it's something that's so common and people may not even think about, but if persons think about it, what's the program? What's deity worship? So Prabhupada is explicit. The deity is carved or formed from wood or stone or metal, and those are material ingredients. And so those that don't understand what Archavigraha is, they reject it because it's material. Why worship something material? So there are many different counter replies to that notion. What Prabhupada does here is he says the Lord is affirmed again and again in the Vedas as Kaivalya. Kaivalya. Kaivalya is a very strong word. Like Kevala Bhakti, absolute, or Kevala Advaita, absolute. That Shankara's teaching is Kevala Advaita. The absolute non-dualism. So they like Kevala. We like Kevala. But how we understand the word kevala in relation to the Supreme is different than how they understand it. He is one alone, kaivalya, one alone. How does Prabhupada consistently speak about this one alone? He says the Lord is asamordva. Asam, sama is equal. Asama means there is, he has no equal. And ordva means greater. He has no one who is greater. Asama aorva, ordva. Neither is there someone equal to him, nor is there someone greater than him. So that kind of eliminates, he's the greatest. There's no competitor, there's no equal. There's some ideologies, ideologies, that take it that there's God, and then there's God's competitor. So the good and evil, or God and Satan. And then Satan is always struggling against God, trying to dominate God. And so Satan sometimes, in their ideology, theology, or whatever it is, thinks, you know, this is satanic influence, and so we should go to God's side and fight against the satanic influences, and so God will be victorious. The Vedic version is asamordva. There's no equal to God. There's no competitor. There's no one greater than him. There's no one equal to him. He's kaivalya. One alone. And with that notion of kaivalya, so what is this understanding of matter? Matter is, in a conventional sense, viewed as minus spirit. But what is there in when you think of God, what is there that's minus God's presence? There's no such thing. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada has said it like this. There's no void in the kingdom of God. There is God, and there is God's, that the property of God, and there's not a third thing. There's not something that exists apart from the existence of God, even if it's nothing. There's no void in the creation of God. That would mean there's something there where God doesn't exist. There's something where God doesn't exist. There's no something where God doesn't exist. There's God or his expansions, and there isn't a third thing. So that's this kaivalya. And so he doesn't detail it, but therefore in him there's no material contamination. There's the limitation of stone or wood or metal is not so with insofar as the Lord is concerned. Since he is one without a second, asamordva, therefore the Lord can appear in any form without being contaminated by the material conception. Neither contacted by the laws of nature, like the temporary ness, the asat ness of matter. After some time, because everything in this material world is dissolved, and ultimately at the time of cosmic annihilation, wood deities can, after some time, become very old. Brass deities, after some time, can become tarnished. Marble deities may last for a long time, but they're not forever. So one could argue This is material. But the Lord is not dependent upon those forms to manifest himself. Rather, by mercy, he manifests himself as those forms. And he can be worshipped that way. And on festivals, he's indicating here Janmashtami and Julun. He just passed that season, Julun Yatra season, where many people come to participate. And it's a nice festival. It's nice because the Lord is enjoying. And therefore we enjoy because the Lord is enjoying. Like swinging the swing. One can, you know, the cynic or the materialist can look at that, oh, that's silly. But the happiness is not just in the mind. The happiness is because the Lord is receiving happiness. You're swinging him on a swing. He likes. It's an act of devotion. We're rendering that little service. Or Govardhan Puja. Coming up. Govardhan Puja is such a nice festival. And why is it so nice? Krishna's enjoying. Because Krishna's enjoying. It's such a nice festival. I attended... I was in Ukraine once during the Kartik month, or part of the Kartik month, with Niranjan Maharaj. And they have this Govardhan Puja festival that every year that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. They have a cake in the capital of Ukraine. The capital is Kiev, or Kiev. They say it locally, Kiev. And the cake, because it gets bigger and bigger, they have to rent a hall. And the cake fills the hall. And it's on television because who has seen a cake that big? And all the people come out to circumambulate around this huge, huge cake. I saw some, you know, footage of it taken right off the television. It's a phenomenon. And everybody comes. Everybody comes. Doesn't matter, old, young, believers, non-believers, they got to circumambulate that cake. And they sing Damodarastakam song, you know, even they don't even know what it is because they speak Russian. They sing it in Sanskrit. It's enjoyable. Why is it enjoyable? Because the Lord is enjoying. And it's fun, the distribution of the cake. But why is it fun? It's the Lord is enjoying. Otherwise it wouldn't, you know, it's not just some transplanted culture and people like it because it's fun. It's the Lord's happiness. And it's such a nice thing because people are then engaged in the Lord's happiness. That's the festival. And so the ladies are standing on the rooftops and for them it's a festival to see Krishna. And along with seeing Krishna is all the festivity, the decorations and the music and the dance and the drama and the narrators and the singers and the decorations and then darshan. It's just like festival. Only it's the festival that we may, you know, Ram's return from Ayodhya, or to Ayodhya from exile. It's a big festival. Big festival. So it's imitating or is a replica of the original festival. And if one enters into the mood of it, it's very joyful. Very joyful. There's a temple, I'll share this. There's a temple in America, in a state, one of the states, the state is Utah. It sounds funny, Utah. Mm-hmm. And it's the headquarters, the international headquarters of the Mormon Church. The Mormon Church is a very, very quickly growing for the disorganization. And this temple is in Spanish Fork, Utah, very near the capital of the state of Utah. And they have this festival. They have a number of festivals that are right on with the Vedic culture, only they do it. No, they do it with music on the stage, like, you know, the burning of, just the firing, of shooting of arrows to kill Ravan. So they have build a big effigy of Ravan, and they have a big piece of land, and so it's safe near a big fountain, and they fire arrows, and they get, you know, a permit, because they have to do stuff like that in America. You get a fire department permit to hold the festival where they're having a fire, and then he falls in the lake. and they have thousands of young Americans paying money to go and attend the festival. Now they have holy festivals. They buy these bags of dye in India, and they sell them for something $5 a bag. You know, yellow and blue and red and green, and you have basic colors, and the kids, some, you know, 5,000 kids, young American, you know, Christians, Mormons, they come to this festival and have kirtan, and then when it's the time to throw the dye, it's like, you know, they get into it, and then he explains what's the meaning of holy, what's the meaning of the killing of Ravan. It's not like it's just... So he's introducing them to the teaching of Krishna consciousness in a way that young American people can really relate. They have a great time. And they love prasadam. They love the kirtan. And they, at least philosophically, they have an idea of what they're doing, because he gives a very clear explanation. Anyway, interesting way to introduce people to Ram and Krishna, Lila. The ladies, they were actually seeing Krishna. And a short part of the purport, and it carries over to the next one, is the respectability of the elevated ladies. There were, if you recall, those that went out to greet Krishna, they were all men. It's not like, you know, the only men that lived in Dwarka. There's ladies that lived in Dwarka. The ladies stayed at their homes, and Prabhupada explains that it's obvious that they were of great wealth. There was great wealth in Dwarka, because they were on the roofs of palaces. So this thing has a roof, but it's not a palace. Far from it. So they were on the roofs of the palaces. And this was preserving their respectability. It was demonstrating their respectability, and it was preserving their respectability. Here's how Prabhupada writes. The ladies did not mix with the crowd on the street, and thus their respectability was perfectly observed. Then he goes the other direction. There was no artificial equality with the man, you know, the idea of today, modern. Some modern women behave just like men, dress just like men, behave just like men. And it's encouraged by modern materialism. It adds to the fun, it adds to the excitement, it adds to the gross national product. You have more laborers, you have more people that can work. More people that are working, the more people earning. More people earning, the more they're spending. It's good for the gross national product. More consumer goods can be produced if you have more people earning more money. crazy. So, Vedic culture was not like that. Rather, female respectability is preserved more elegantly by keeping the women separate from the man, keeping the woman separate from the man. It's respectability, preserving respectability in an elegant way. It's not discrimination or, you know, any looking down kind of discrimination. It's as Prabhupada expresses it so nicely. It's respectability, it's elegant, it's the attractiveness of a woman is her shyness. The power of a woman is her shyness. So those things are in modern culture are lost, unfortunately. The sexes should not mix unrestrictedly. He doesn't go into it extensively. He just makes short, powerful statements. And he continues in the following purport. The verse for text 25, the inhabitants of Dwarka were regularly accustomed to look upon the reservoir of all beauty, the infallible Lord, yet they were never satiated. So Prabhupada does three things in the purport. He speaks about the law of satiation. He speaks about infallible, fallible, infallible. And again, he speaks about the role of, the proper role of ladies in Vedic culture, in a cultured society. He writes, on the ladies' topic, when the ladies of the city of Dwarka got up on the roofs of their palaces, they never thought that they had previously many times seen the beautiful body of the infallible Lord. This indicates they had no satiation in desiring to see the Lord. It's indicating that their shyness, their respectability, their preserving in an elegant way their elevated nature, but they weren't at all tired of seeing the Lord. Oh, I've seen him so many times, why go on the rooftop? With the law of satiation, second point is the law of satiation is I've had enough. Like, you know, you can only drink so much water, you can only eat so much food, you can only sleep so much, you can only, you know, material things, you can only do them so much. Even people may like them. You can only do them so much. At some point, it's enough. But there's no such satiation with regard to the Lord. On the spiritual platform, the law of satiation doesn't apply. Or conversely, the law of satiation applies to the material platform. It doesn't apply to Krishna. So he writes, no one therefore is satiated by seeing the transcendental body of the Lord because there are always manifestations of newer and newer beauties. You know, it's like reading Bhagavad Gita. Every time you read Bhagavad Gita, you find newer, newer things. They're always the same Bhagavad Gita. Not like the words changed. But because the subject is Krishna, when you read, new things come out. It's not just our mind is different. That may also be the case, but Krishna is ever fresh. And newer realizations. In the Bhagavatam, it's described in Chaitanya Charitamrita that when Lord Chaitanya went to visit at the Gopinath temple where Ganadhar Pandit was worshipping Gopinath, they would discuss Srimad Bhagavatam and they would hear the same section of the Bhagavatam 100 times. And they would say, oh, I've heard that. All right, let's go to another section. Again and again with relish. And Rosh Chaitanya, after hearing it, he would say to Gadadhar, say it again, say it again. Because it's relishing the ever-freshness of transcendental Lord, the body of the Lord, the name of the Lord, the descriptions of His qualities and activities and pastimes. You can hear again and again and again. And it's ever fresh. So therefore the law of satiation doesn't apply. The transcendental name, form, qualities, entourage, etc. are all spiritual manifestations. And therefore there's no satiation in chanting the holy name of the Lord. There's no satiation in discussing the qualities of the Lord. There is no limitation of the entourage of the Lord. He is the source of all and is limitless. So that's the ladies and then the satiation factor and then infallible. So the verse is saying, although the residents of Dwarka were accustomed to seeing the form of the Lord so many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, he, the infallible Lord, was the object. So infallible, Prabhupada writes, the word infallible is significant here because although the Lord has mercifully descended on earth, He is still infallible. We can't say that about the living entity. The living entity doesn't exactly, the language would be different, doesn't descend on earth. The living entity falls. And when living entity falls, it comes in contact with matter, Prabhupada writes, they lack their spiritual identity. It's not like the soul stops existing. That's not the meaning. But the soul loses track of his own spiritual identity. In that sense, they lack their spiritual identity. They lose their sense of their real identity and think instead in terms of matter. And that, therefore, the living entity is chuta, or fallible. And the Lord, although He descends, He's achuta. He remains infallible. So He's coming into Dwarka, this opulent city, but He's not losing His divinity or His self-awareness, His understanding of who He really is. Although He's interacting with the residents of Dwarka like their friends and sons and fathers and kings and ladies and just appropriate to their social position, He's reciprocating according to their devotion. He's reciprocating, but He's not losing His own sense of the source of all those things. I mean, who can imagine what that experience is like? What Krishna's experiencing? This is all His energy. And there's love of the living entities towards Him, the object, and they're expressing it in an appropriate way. The ladies from the rooftops and the sons coming and bowing at His feet and Ugrasena receiving Krishna's obeisances. And the drama is unfolding, but it's loving reciprocation. Transcendental loving reciprocation. And all the while, Krishna doesn't lose His infallible position or nature. Whereas, in a moment, we can forget something that we very clearly understand, get some great realization about it, and the next moment is forgotten. Due to material contact, which we're so prone to. So, why is it that the ladies and all of the residents were so attracted to Krishna? Because his body is all spiritual. When the living entity comes into the fallible living entity who comes in contact with matter receives a body, a covering. And the covering goes through changes, eventually dies, grows, produces byproduct stages, sometimes dwindles and it's gone. But not Krishna's body. Therefore, his body is the source of everything that be, the reservoir of all beauties, beyond our experience, and now they're experiencing. They're thrilled. They can't take their eyes off this grand festival of seeing the Supreme Lord. Who can understand the jubilation that they must be feeling? Something like, you know, when you have a good day, you know, one morning you chant your rounds really well and you feel, wow. And then the next day it's a struggle again. These are pure devotees. It's not, you know, a moment of some light coming through the darkness. They're seeing the Lord, fully knowing who he is, fully experiencing his spiritual potencies. They're so happy. Especially in contrast to the long separation they've had to endure. They're very happy. Transcendentally happy. And that's the theme of this chapter. It's Sambhog. After a long separation, again uniting. And this is an understanding that here it's right in the first canto. And as we develop, going through the cantos, develop more deeply the spiritual conception, spiritual realization, the pastimes of the Lord with his devotees, it escalates and grows and grows, becomes, if we were to follow the path of Srimad Bhagavatam very, very carefully, canto by canto, it's the path of God realization. It just becomes more and more ecstatic with deepened realization of transcendental consciousness, if we take it up in the proper way. Transcendental literature. Not like the rubbish literature of modern time. The Delhi airport was filled with newspapers. And after people would read the newspaper, they just toss it in the seat next to them, it falls on the floor, and people walk on it. And somebody comes up, picks it up, and throws it in the trash. Like, you know, but they're so absorbed in so many, like 18 different newspapers. They read one, they got to read the next one, read the next one. Literature that's a pilgrimage for the crows. Mm-hmm. And the Bhagavatam is swan-like pilgrimage for the swans. Any discussion on the morning's verse? Yeah?
Explaining that the devotees are so naturally attracted towards the Lord, and That is the reason for such festivities, and that brings freshness in the jubilation in the heart.
Yeah.
And here, when they are explaining for a practicing devotee, one day I do, next day again soil. So how do you understand that they will somewhat do reasonably well? Next day, while the soil comes, purification has already happened to some extent, and again.
What's your question? Why do we find ups and downs in Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti? That's your question?
Yes, ma'am.
It's many factors. It, you know, boil it down into two very simple ones. It's effort and mercy. Some days we make more effort. We're more present. We're more calling out with eagerness. You've got, you know, it may certainly be that there's things troubling us or nothing troubling us. It's not materially determined. It's, you know, good association. We've heard, we're applying, and we're calling out. So it's effort and mercy. Good association. And the other is, it's not, oh, Krishna's being mean, or I'm being punished, or... It's just, it's our material condition. And from the disposition of a devotee, it's not so much important to understand why the down instead of the up, as much as just accept our position. We're dependent. So let me try to serve the master. It's quite simple. According to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the unsteadiness of bhakti or anishtita bhakti is due to anarthas within the heart. You know, that's the science of it. And then anarthas are there based upon there's the source of those anarthas, where from whence they arise. So there's different categories of anarthas based upon their origin. So, you know, there's a science to it all. But so we can say that the ups and the downs are due to our impurities. So let us try to become pure. Something else?
Can you explain that the festival, the moon of the ladies and the moon of the God is because the Lord is enjoying the moon and joy. Devotee, how should we approach these festivals?
How should we approach
the festivals?
Festivals. You asked that question a little bit yesterday. What ways, as you know, we're not Dwarka Vasis, we're something else. So the safe position is regulative. We just follow the vidhis of Vidhi Sadhana Bhakti and do them nicely. But when we're doing them nicely, we should also, part of nicely is to understand what's the purpose behind them. It's to make an offering to the Lord. So like this nice decoration on the floor. It's artistic. Some people, you know, may like art. Oh, that's nice. But the purpose behind it is, it's to enhance the pleasure of the Lord. So he doesn't need this. Mm-hmm. But it's part of... So how do we follow the vidhis and enter into the purpose of, the mood of, the purpose of, purpose behind the offerings? Yeah? And that way it's not just, you know, you keep the mind from being the devil's workshop. You give it something to do. But more than just keep it, you know, the preventing the negative, it's enter into the positive. Let this be an offering to Krishna. And that's how to take up festivals. And it's really nice to plan. You can anticipate the festival. Oh, there's some festivals coming up. We just passed some, now there's some more coming. It's always like that. And you know, plan how to have a nice Govardhan Puja festival. Nice Prabhupada disappearance festival. Plan it, and, you know, get excited and share and execute. And but you do it in standard ways. You don't create, imagine something. So we stay regulated by the vidhis of Vidhi Sadhana Bhakti, and we try to incubate in that chamber our desire to offer to Krishna and serve Krishna. Same question.
When we hear about the question of Lord's devotees or pure devotees with the devotees, then what are the things and what we have to take it in the proper way so that we can progress in at our stage of devotion?
How we take it? Krishna is loving. And because we're just like little babies in our awakening of Krishna consciousness, we're not going to experience what they experience because our capacity is not developed yet. But it's a little bit like, you know, a role model. When I grow up, I can anticipate it's going to be like this. It's an inspiration to go further on the path of devotion. And you one can contemplate and even relish such sweet loving exchanges. And it gives us an indication also of how to, although we're not cultured and refined, how one who is cultured and refined acts. It gives us like yardsticks or standards by which to measure. Points us in a direction. Go that way, not that way. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm staying out there because I don't want to expose that I'm practicing. So
because you don't want to?
Expose that I'm practicing this process. I don't want to expose.
You don't want to spoil the process?
I don't want to expose that I'm practicing. Expose.
Okay, you don't want to. Oh, it was okay.
So many times I compromise many things. So how can I really protect them?
How can you do which? How can you not be compromised while you're compromised? You know, I don't know the details of the situation, so it's hard to comment on what to do, what not to do, and how to navigate that territory, that, you know, the gap, without knowing the details. So I don't feel it would be appropriate to try to just like jump in without knowing anything and say all kinds of things. Wouldn't be appropriate. There must be a reason. You say the reason, you know, why the situation is what it is. It's so that you don't want others to understand. You don't want it to be in the forefront of their consciousness that you're doing what you're doing. For that reason, I'm living the way I'm living. Because I'm living the way I'm living, I'm compromised. At least your internal consciousness should be not compromised. And pray for that opportunity when you can not be externally compromised. Whatever that entails. Without knowing the details, I can't comment. So in the course of time, it would be nice. Krishna, please give some indication through the course of time how that can happen, and I'll gladly take those steps as appropriate. I mean, taking your question, putting in another context, or another frame of reference, we're in the material world and we don't belong here. We're compromised just by being here. But what to do, because we're here. So it's valuable, although we're here and doing so many things, to have an aspiration to be with Krishna in the spiritual world, where we're not compromised. But now I'm here, and I have so many duties, at least I think I have so many duties, responsibilities, and obligations. That's a statement of faith more than is a statement of fact. The statement of fact is we're actually ultimately dependent upon one person. And all of the persons who would think we're dependent upon pleasing, well, it's part of the construct of illusion. That there was one person that we're to please. And that's Krishna. But if our consciousness hasn't evolved and matured to that stage, then we're feeling pulled in by so many other obligations. So if you're not with Krishna in the spiritual world, you're in this material world with a sense of duty and obligation and commitment and responsibility. So then I have to grow my Krishna consciousness internally. Carefully. That requires the protection requires careful guidance. To do otherwise is just imagination. I think I'll do this, I think I'll do that, and the whole world is operating on that principle without any guidance. Okay. I didn't answer your question directly because I don't have the information to do that. I'm speaking principles. Yes.
What is
main thing that the spiritual master or preceptor is feeling is the.
What's the main thing that the spiritual master or preceptor?
Is what are the things that spiritual master pleases most with the disciple?
What's pleasing the most? You know, let's bring it down a little bit and say this, what's pleasing? Pleasing the most is that the devotee becomes a pure lover of Krishna. So, like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, this mind fully absorbed in me, intelligence engaged in me, surely you'll live in me always, without a doubt. That's most pleasing. Become like that. Or be like that. We're not there. We're at the stage of anishta sadhana bhakti. Unsteady devotional, you know, devotional practices. So when one is in that stage of unsteady devotional practices, something that I can say I personally look to see that as this is the criterion that's satisfying me, is that the individual, whether they're on top of a mountain or down in a valley, they're doing great or they're struggling terribly, that's not the criterion. The criterion is that they're consciously acting within the relationship. They're consciously acting within, according to their capacity at the moment, and because it can fluctuate, all over the place it can fluctuate. They're acting in that relationship, consciously acting in that relationship, according to their capacity, their position. Their another phrase is they're present, as opposed to absent. Mm-hmm. You know what that means? Does that resonate with you? To be present, just like right now, I'm paying undivided attention to you and your question. But if I was, let me think about it. Let me see, maybe I should do something else for a while. I got a lot of things I got to do, I don't know if I can answer your question. That's called absent. I'll be present. But, when you're chanting, be present with the holy name. And even if you're in one of those down periods of chanting, you're striving to act in a relationship with Krishna, from whatever your position is. That's what's important. You can use different language to describe all of that. Person is acting from the heart. One way of describing. Following the vidhis, the rules and regulations, will flow from that. So that's an external criterion. A strict follower. But what that's resting upon is they're in that relationship very firmly. Striving to act in that relationship according to their capacity. So if the capacity is weak, then there'll be irregularities in the vidhis. The irregularities will be surpassed because if one is acting in the relationship, they'll get easily overcome. easily. And otherwise, it's just perpetual struggle. So acting within the relationship is a simple phrase. That will cure everything. Yeah.
Many times you desire to practice these structures and influence just becomes.
Wait. The voice gets a little louder every now and then. So there are times when one tries to practice. Desires.
Flickering.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you've got the right entity. It's the mind that's flickering. So, what to do? Well, I'll give you the one stroke method, the blacksmith method is get onto the platform of the soul, not on the platform of the mind. Because the mind is flickering. Chanchala himana Krishna. And not only flickering, it's very strong. Bhagavad. Very difficult to control the mind. So one formula is, Krishna gives right there, is constant practice and detachment. Constant practice. Keep striving. This is the acting in the relationship message. Keep striving. And detachment. Detachment. Detachment means attachment to the object of Krishna, or the goal, the spiritual goal, the spiritual master, representatives of Krishna. That is tantamount to, it's not different from detachment. You don't have detachment without attachment. So the focus of our attachment needs to change, and then you get detachment. Focus on sat and detachment from asat. Na sate vijate bhavo, na bhavo vijate sataha. Nice verse. Ubayor api drishto dhastvanios tattvadarshi bhi. Krishna describes the tattvadarshi is one who goes for sat. You invest consciousness in that which is eternal. Withdraw consciousness from that which is temporary. So the flickering mind is due to the contemplation on the temporary. It's contemplation in the realm of duality. Withdraw consciousness and invest consciousness in the realm of the eternal, on the platform of the soul. Like I was describing what the Bhagavatam is doing. The Bhagavatam, if we absorb our consciousness in the Bhagavatam, automatically we're drawn to Krishna. And with that is detachment. Vasudevi Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha Janayata Yashu Vairagyam Gyanamcha Yadahaitukam. Causelessly, ahaituki. Causelessly, knowledge and detachment awaken in the heart. When devotion for Krishna, Vasudeva Bhagavati, Bhakti Yoga, Prayojataha, Janiyati Ashu Vairagyam. So, if we cultivate devotion to Sat, to Krishna, Vasudev, bhakti, or Krishna bhakti, devotion to Krishna, we're called, then that's bringing the mind to Sat. And with that, asat, detachment. Constant practice and detachment from asat. So when we value asat, the mind wants to go to asat. Like, you know, do I have a pain in my foot? Or does somebody like me? Or, you know, I have an exam I have to study for. Or, you know, my mother is calling me, or, you know, something. Something. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is. The wind's blowing the wrong direction. I don't like that lady singing so loud out there. You know, whatever. Asat. The mind goes to asat, then you can't bring the mind to sat. Because it's distracted by the pain in the foot, or the whatever it is. But you go down the list. So many things that are our consciousness is invested in. That's asat. It's temporary. We deal with this temporary world in a responsible way, but our consciousness should be fixed in. That's why, you know, Krishna is infallible, and those that are attached to Krishna become infallible. Because they become attached to the infallible. They become infallible. And that means they're, although in touch with asat, they're not bewildered by it. That's detachment. Our happiness is not what's the configuration of matter today. If that's the standard of one's happiness, oh, that's flickering, to say the least. You know, the world economy, for example. That's flickering. The whole world is being affected by, you know, speculation on the values of commodities and stocks. Oh, people are literally dying. They're dying. There's no reason to live anymore because all that value I had is now gone. But it was no value. It was no value to begin with. It was in the mind that it was value. And so the flickering status of the mind, that yesterday's happiness is today's calamity. But they're always hopeful it's going to get better again. One needs to deal in a responsible way with this world, but in a spirit of detachment, and that's only possible when there's attachment to the Supreme. Chapter 5, Bhagavad Gita, that which is called renunciation, is actually yoga linking with the Supreme. So it's not a renunciation I don't care, it's a renunciation of, it's not determining my happiness and distress. I'm dutiful. I'll act in this world in a theistic way, according to the codes of religion, but my attachment is for the Supreme. So constant practice, constant practice. And like this earlier discussion, the flickering, the anishtita bhakti, is caused by anartas, the unsteadiness. Cause is anartas. Anartas means things unwanted in the heart. So I need to cleanse those unwanted things in the heart. Therefore, I'll continue steadfastly this acting in the relationship idea, but continue to abhyasa yoga yuktena. I'll continue to practice abhyasa. I continue to practice with faith that the means will reach, take me to the Supreme. That's the goal. If I, you know, speaking about the decorations at festivals, it's not the decorations is the essence. It's the devotion is the essence. And the decoration becomes an expression of the essence. It's not the essence. It's an expression of devotion, which is the essence. So, for the materialist, all of what I've just said is bewildering. For a practicing devotee, it's guidance. And in the stage of pure devotion, it's the essence. It's our relationship with Krishna, that's the essence. Then there's no flickering. The movements of the wind may be there. Sometimes it's moving swifter than others. And when the wind moves, objects move. Things are moving. But that's not, my consciousness can remain fixed. Not flickering. Because consciousness, when consciousness is absorbed in that which is unchanging, Krishna, the soul, start with the soul. It's not changing. It's not coming into being, going out of being. It's not withered by the wind, moistened by water, cut by any weapon. It's not moved by anything material. While everything material is moving, it's unmoving. Let my consciousness go there. And that's what it takes. Abhyasa, it takes practice. So constant practice. And detachment. That's Krishna's direct instruction to Arjuna, how to curb the restless mind. Constant practice and detachment. Well, we had a lively morning. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Raj, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.
Jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.